Guten Tag, meine Damen und Herren. Erstmal herzlichen Dank für die Einladung. Es ist eine Ehre für mich, hier zu sein im Haus der Weltkulturen, ein Platz der Zusammenkunft, ein Platz der Begegnung, ein Platz des Dialogs. And that's the extent of my German. So before I continue embarrassing myself, let me go back to English. And tell you that, or rather invite you to think about this little proposal, that someone should write a small book of philosophers' dreams. I believe the history of our aspiration to justice must be told from an entirely new perspective. And I want to propose today one such perspective may come from the dreams reported by those who have done their best to analyze and theorize the ways we relate to each other and to objects, pass judgment, value, mourn, or let go, which are characteristic of our existential condition as humans. You might know, of course, that in ancient Greece, Socrates tells us that the choice between poetry and philosophy as mediums for engaging in the pursuit of truth and the practice of truth-saying in public speech came to him in a dream. Meanwhile, in China, Shuangzi dreamed he was a butterfly. Upon waking up, he was famously unable to determine whether Shuangzi had just dreamt he was a butterfly or a butterfly still dreaming of being Shuangzi. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas considered the prophetic, future divining qualities of dreams. And we're all familiar with Descartes' dream argument in Meditations 1. We might not know, though, that he was beaten by 500 years when in his deliverance from error, Al-Ghazali delivered the first sustained argument from the existence of dreaming to the groundlessness of our waking life certainties. Now, I believe Al-Ghazali may have been, in fact, the inventor of our modern notion of risk. But a favorite of mine is Baruch Spinoza's dream, reported on 20 July 1664 in a letter that he wrote to his friend Pieter Baling. Baling was a merchant engaged in trade with the Iberian Americas. In the dream, the vivid image of a wretched black Brazilian haunts Spinoza's sleep. Aside from the muted homoeroticism of the dream, I believe this may be the first register of the meaning of tokens in modern Western culture. In the context of the coloniality of the encounter between Europeans, Africans, and Amerindians in the Americas. The image of the black Brazilian disappeared, Spinoza tells us, when, and I quote him, as a diversion, I fixed my eyes on a book or something else. But as soon as I turned my eyes away from such an object while looking at nothing in particular, the same image of the same Ethiopian kept appearing with the same vividness again and again and again. That's Spinoza. Now we know who the black Brazilian is, a slave, no less. But since this is a dream, and in the absurd logic of dreams, something may always stand for something else, we can also say that the mangy Brazilian, the individual in question, is here merely a token of given types. If this is the case, then the relation between the individual reported in the dream and the unifying framework of normalization and standardizations that makes his black body disappear and reappear as a token is one of subsumption. This is confirmed by the operation of the book in the dream, arguably a symbol for universal, unifying, and standard knowledge that literally subsumes, absorbs, or makes the image and the body of the Brazilian slave disappear and then reappear again and again as something else, a substitute object or token. Crucially, for our purposes here, this is the kind of relation that Theodore W. Adorno termed identity thinking, which he presented as the rational and mythic core of thought and practice. For him, rationalization means the comprehension of or meaning of individuals is increasingly had through their location within conceptual schemes whose fundamental terms are invariant and unchanging. As can be seen, what Adorno calls identity thinking is precisely what we term standardization. Basically, standardization means the subsumption, inclusion, or absorption of something, for instance, a voice, a body, or a communal practice, in something else. More precisely, a conceptual, visual, or normative and normalizing a scheme, the terms of which are fundamentally invariant. This something else that is fundamentally invariant comes to stand for, both in the place of and as the place for, what has been absorbed, the silenced voice, the missing body, or the devalued practice. A most powerful example of this logic of subsumption or absorption as substitution that for Adorno is the core, at the same time rational and mythical, of thought and political practice is the historical silencing of the voice of women. Its expropriation and reappropriation as an objectified set of standards ready to hand, or rather to voice, to mouth, in the rhetorical toolbox of public speech, labeled as inherently male. In her brilliant book, Women and Power, classical historian Mary Beard narrates how it came to happen that the voices and bodies of women were trampled upon and taken over from antiquity onwards by men, so that they, the latter, could effectively brand the space and the rules of public speech, from politics to law and the post-war discourse of human rights, as their own. Add to this brief genealogy the accounts of anthropologists according to which women had been exchanged among traditional groups in accordance to the law prohibiting incest so as to arrange marriage alliances and foundational treaties between groups to form societies, and what you get is the critical suggestion that the trampled, violated, decapitated, and silenced bodies of women were used, have been used as tokens from the very outset. This is the original universal money. The accounts of anthropologists proved contentious on this very aspect, in that the rationalizations of the meaning of myths concerning the genealogy of law in the standard prohibition of incest seemed to hide at its core and cover over the cruelty and quantity of the violence that must have occurred for the voices of women to be silenced and their bodies vanquished, so that those same bodies and ways of speaking could be turned into tokens of themselves, but this time branded by men as theirs and theirs alone, actually demarcating the space of public speech, politics, and law as exclusively patriarchal. Now think about the disappearing body of the mangy black Brazilian in Spinoza's dream in a similar way, and you get a very good idea of what coloniality and its accompanying civilization narrative condensed in the concept of sovereignty has meant historically. The imposition of white patriarchal rule in history and to history as something inherent, seemingly natural as the gold standard. For me, this means we must posit once more the question concerning the object as substitute or token of the vanquished body, of objects gathered where a meeting of speaking voices or actual bodies could have been, now carved up or displaced and mined by something else or someone else to accumulate their value for plunder. It means asking again, where did these bodies go? The bodies of the disappeared, the voices of the silenced women subject to oblivion, the peoples obliterated by the promise of civilization. Weren't they part of a record that would serve as the basis of a case of law and reparation? Coming as I do from Colombia in Latin America, a country where the apotheosis of war has taken place for over 60 years and in which a woman is killed every other day, I know these questions, hailing from the distant classical past, are very much a matter of the present and the future. I'm also reminded by the very anthropologists who travel far to seek the genealogy of laws, standards, and obligations in the prohibition of incest and their Amerindian interlocutors that the dream in question may have been there, hidden in plain sight as a collective fantasy for as long as we founded our societies of inclusively exclusive laws and public speech conventions. Mankind's, and notice I said mankind's, not humankind's, mystified dream of, and I quote one anthropologist, seizing and fixing the fleeting moment when it was permissible to believe that the law of exchange could be evaded, that one could gain without losing, enjoy without sharing, in which all social forms of value and reproduction, which by definition are not containable within the self or the group, and thus must come from elsewhere, are displaced and deferred to the unattainable past or future of a world in which one might keep to oneself and keep for oneself all the women, all the money. Many of the anthropologists' interlocutors were women, whose silenced bodies and abnormalized sexual practices become predominant once you begin to look for them, hidden in the record of travel writing between Europe and the Americas from the 16th century onwards. It is here that the genealogy of standardization must begin in earnest. It teaches us at least two lessons. First, that the logic of subsumption as substitution is at the heart not only of the dream conjuring the image of a black Brazilian body, the sex of Amerindian women, the voice of Penelope told to shut up by Telemachus, or the vanquished body of Medusa, decapitated and trampled, I almost said trampled, by Perseus, that obscure precursor of the Donald J. Trumps of today's world. It is rather the very promise of civilization and development. Second, as said before, we must pay closer attention to the object. Let me repeat. Second, as said before, we must pay closer attention to the object, or the fetish, if you prefer, as substitute and token for the vanquished body, for the trampled body. For the logic of substitution is also the logic of value in our modern societies concerned solely with expropriation, displacement, and accumulation of voices and bodies. The mining of data. That should be our focus, the silenced voices, the missing bodies, the missing peoples. Individualized and turned into tokens of invariant types, neither nation nor sovereignty. Isn't that precisely, and let us call that image onto the stage, what Eugene Delacroix was getting at when he depicted the death of Southern Appalus? It is difficult not to notice that what the painting portrays is exactly not the moment of Southern Appalus's death, the fabled sovereign of the Persians, but that of the women around him and his horse, whose bodies became and become, in the painting, derivative, mere tokens of given types, as Adorno said. This is in keeping with the ancient tradition according to which, to avoid sacrificing the king, to substitute him for one of his generals, and to avoid punishing the latter, you have him killing his horse, the horse-killing ritual at the basis of sovereignty in Vedic India, for instance. Of course, we no longer sacrifice our kings. We don't even decapitate them, as the French did. Hell, we no longer have kings, and we don't execute their generals. We trial them. Civilized nations we are. And yet, for all the differences condensed in the 1948 Universal Declaration on Human Rights, and the Nuremberg trials precedents, for all our differences with the ancient Indians and the Greek or the revolutionary French or the Haitians, one common theme remains. The victim must be substituted. Now, how do we substitute or let go of the missing bodies and silenced voices if they remain hidden in the records that would serve as the basis of a case of reparations? How do we make them reappear, count, and matter if they didn't matter when they were alive? We might need a different mode of counting here, of number and pricing, different from the predatory logics of sovereignty, substitution, and derivation depicted in Delacroix's Death of Sardanapalus.